Welcome to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. In years past, if work or schedules or budgets got in the way of traveling home for Thanksgiving, I'd at least celebrate with friends and end up just as full and drunk as I would have if I'd been eating with my family. But this year is obviously different. No matter if it's a Friendsgiving or a good old family Thanksgiving, these meals are not going according to plan. The uninvited guest this year is COVID. And that's exactly why we're revisiting the subject today. Obvi, a ton has changed since March, and it feels like a lot more will change in the coming few weeks. In light of this, we have another fabulous episode on the docket today. First, we'll recap this week's top headlines. Then go into our COVID update and history. Then we'll close out the show with my interview with infectious disease and modern pandemic historian, Andrew Kishuni. No cocktail screams Thanksgiving more than a vodka cranberry. Go ahead and shake up your drink just like COVID shook up 2020, and let's get started. First, this week's headlines. Many states are reporting that they do not have the money to distribute a coronavirus vaccine. Maybe states should just stop eating so much avocado toast. Over the weekend, thousands of Trump supporters took to the streets for a protest they called MAGA Millions. Since they had nowhere near a million people at the march, I can only assume that millions is in reference to how many people they have infected with COVID. According to the New York Times, a number of doctors are calling it quits due to pressures of the coronavirus. Now, if only the coronavirus would call it quits due to stress from doctors. This week, Moderna released a possible vaccine that is 94.5% effective in stopping COVID-19. If this percentage was a grade, by my prep school standards, it would still only be an A-. If COVID wants to get that A+, 100% grade point average, there's got to be some extra credit involved. The curricula states that bonus points can be earned by washing hands, social distancing, and wearing a mask. Biden's education department will be quick to reverse Betsy DeVos's policies. So far, the whole Biden campaign is the equivalent of asking a genie for more wishes and the genie being like, yeah, okay. Russian military boats have been making aggressive moves off the shores of Alaska. It turns out, this is part of Trump's continued environmental policy, where we don't have to worry about the environment if we all die from a nuclear holocaust. Trump would be the worst to play board games with. Just imagine, he loses the game and then rage flips the board. I can just hear it. If I can't win, no one can. Throughout the last few weeks, election officials directly contradicted Trump on voting system fraud. As a comedian, it's really frustrating that the headlines themselves are the punchlines. The GOP made statements saying they would only indulge Trump's conspiracy theories for so long. The fact that they indulged his conspiracy theories at all makes me question what they're like as parents. Listen, Tommy, I will only let you chase your brother around with a knife for so long. This week, Trump fired Director of Cybersecurity, Christopher Krebs, after his announcement that the 2020 election was, quote, the most secure election in American history. Our sources tell us his next career move will be opening a burger shack in Bikini Bottom. And that was this week's headlines. This week's episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated is brought to you by Theater in the Dark, A War of the Worlds, a virtual audio drama. A link to tickets will be listed in the show notes.
No one would have believed.
You see this? What's happening in the suburbs?
In the first years of the 21st century.
Wi-Fi's not working.
That this world was being watched keenly and closely.
What's happening?
By intelligences greater than our own.
That's in Kankakee. We should drive out and see it.
Careful. Don't get too close.
Dr. Pearson, have there been fresh attempts to signal these beings?
This October.
It's something more than a meteorite.
Theater in the Dark presents...
It's a cylinder.
And it's opening.
A War of the Worlds. A virtual audio drama performed live every night over Zoom. Pay what you can tickets available now at theaterinthedark.com.
Next, this week's deep dive. It has been 8 months since we released our episode on the coronavirus. A lot of the information about what we know has changed since then. When the episode was first released, the CDC was telling people not to wear masks unless they were exhibiting symptoms. We now know that was just because they were trying to conserve masks for medical purposes. But nonetheless, man, do we seem dumb back then? Point is, while we released our episode on the coronavirus 8 months ago, we haven't stopped talking about it since then. It has become the main factor for what decisions we make on a day-to-day basis, and oddly enough, a contested political subject. Since we live in a society where the president of America chose to let Americans die because it is more convenient to spread disinformation rather than the truth, we figured we would circle back around and issue everyone a well-needed update that will no doubt become invalid when everything changes in exactly 1 week. So let's dive in like a maskless Trump supporter at your local Walmart. Here are the latest COVID updates. As of this week, America has over 11 million confirmed coronavirus cases, with around 250,000 deaths. The total cases worldwide is around 55 million, with around 1.3 million deaths. Meaning America holds the record for having 1/5 of all confirmed cases and deaths. Yikes. To give you an idea of how poorly America has handled the virus, India is responsible for around 9 million confirmed cases and 130,000 confirmed deaths. And India has 4 times as many people as the US. Granted, I don't know how accurate or efficient the testing in India has been, but still, America is by and far running away with this virus, making people great again via purging our population. Republicans are just mad it's not like the movies, I guess, where they get to live out their fantasies of being allowed to murder other people. But remember, telling someone, "You can't say that," because it's morally and ethically wrong, is, in their opinion, trying to control their thoughts. These are real words people have said to me, so I'll just leave that there for you. Getting back to it, COVID has been a part of our everyday vernacular for basically a whole year now, so it feels like second nature at this point. Having COVID in our lives is no different than walking and chewing gum or rubbing your tummy and patting your head. So that means that we know what COVID is, right? Well, for those of you who are in the boat of, "I don't know what COVID is, and at this point I'm too afraid to ask," don't worry, we got you. As we mentioned in our previous episode on the topic, COVID is a strain of a particular strand of virus called the coronavirus. Previous strands of the coronavirus include SARS and MERS. But this particular strain is called COVID-19, which is short for coronavirus 2019. Because despite the virus being a 2020 phenomenon, its first case was documented just before 2020 in December of 2019. Basically, COVID-19 is that kid in your class who has their birthday 2 weeks before school starts and then makes a big deal about it for the rest of the year. COVID-19 is an airborne virus that spreads through tiny droplets in the air. While it is mostly a respiratory virus, it is capable of landing and living on surfaces anywhere from hours to days. This, of course, depends on the surface and the environment. Warmer temperatures and exposure to sunlight will reduce the time the virus survives on surfaces and objects. You can kill the virus with soap and water by washing your hands thoroughly for 20 seconds, or by spraying antibacterial disinfectant directly onto surfaces. You can protect yourself by staying home, especially when sick, limiting social gatherings of 3 or more people, social distancing at a distance of 6 feet or more, washing your hands often, and wearing a mask when going into public. But what's the big news? News of the vaccine, that's what. As of last week, not one, but 2 companies have announced trial vaccines with over 90% success rate. That's a huge deal considering that the virus has been airborne for less than a year. What's frustrating about that is that people are ignorant and don't understand how science works and basically just expect scientists to fix problems. So they don't really understand how big of an achievement this is. Instead, they're annoyed that they had to wait for it to even happen, as if your order off Amazon took more than 2 days to arrive. It's the same ignorance that leads them to believe that the president telling them to get it done has any effect on the timetable in which results are made. But then again, there were people who seriously injected bleach once they heard him float the idea, so what do you expect? Nonetheless, it is those same types of people who continue to downplay the seriousness of the virus. Like they continue to say it's no worse than the flu. Even though COVID is something like 3 times more contagious, can spread asymptomatically, and of course the main difference being that we already have a vaccine for the flu. As if people forgot that before the flu vaccine existed, it killed 50 million people. But I guess this highlights the other main thing that has changed since it came out, and that is how much the virus itself has been politicized. If you want a detailed breakdown of how poorly the Trump administration handled the containment of this virus, I would highly recommend watching the documentary Totally Under Control on Amazon. Truly eye-opening to me, especially because Trump is so influential to his base. They would probably adopt socialist policies if he said he thought it was a good idea. To me, it's an incredibly odd lapse in judgment that he took the stance of denying it. I feel fairly certain that if he had taken the virus seriously and just let the scientists handle it, he probably could have easily walked into re-election. Seriously, it amazes me that people adore this oaf. He claims to be an expert in everything. My favorite example of this is when, before he was president, he appeared in front of Parliament to contest a ruling over one of his golf courses for environmental reasons. He was asked to cite references for his standings, at which point he gave a typical vague answer of experts. Except Parliament isn't 40% of American people, and didn't just accept this answer, and instead pressed him on asking, what experts? To which he responded, me. To which Parliament responded, with audible laughter to his face. What's that quote that people say? Trump is a poor man's idea of a rich man, a weak man's idea of a strong man, and a stupid man's idea of a smart man. But I guess, on that front, not much has changed. Everything else has pretty much gotten worse, probably because people are too lazy to look back at history to even understand what the word pandemic literally means. So we thought we'd break that down for you too. A quick definition for you. A pandemic is a worst-case scenario of an infectious disease in humans. A disease becomes a pandemic when an epidemic spreads beyond a country's borders. An epidemic is when a disease or infection spreads within a community or confined area. And if you need a helpful reminder on which is which, just remember that the prefix pan comes from Greek and means all or everything. So where does COVID-19 fit in terms of pandemics throughout history? We'll get into this a little more in the interview, but here's just a primer into the history that we're working with. Communicable diseases are pretty much as old as mankind itself. That's easy to understand, seeing as personal hygiene is a fairly new phenomenon. But pandemics have literally occurred throughout all of human history. One of the first pandemics known is the Justinian Plague of 541 AD. Diseases are cyclical, and as long as there are humans, diseases will inevitably happen. It's part of what it means to be living on this planet. Probably the most famous of them all, the Michael Jordan of pandemics, if you will, is the bubonic plague, You've probably heard it mentioned before on our political theories episode. This one ravaged through Asia and Europe during the 14th century and killed roughly one-third of Europe's populations. That is an understatement here. But there are a few other pandemics that fly under the radar, including smallpox and the Spanish flu of 1918. Now, smallpox had existed across the world for centuries, but when colonizers landed on North and South America in the 15th century, the indigenous people of these lands had no built-up immunity and no way to naturally fight off this new infection. Smallpox cut down the indigenous populations by tens of millions, and you won't learn about that in your good old regular history book because, well, erasure and systematic racism. One of the other big forgotten pandemics is the 1918 Spanish flu. We'll speak about this more during the interview, but for stats, it began as an avian flu and killed 50 million people worldwide. The first outbreak of this flu happened in Madrid in the spring of 1918, and hence the name, Spanish flu. It quickly spread throughout Europe, Asia, and the Americas, and was prevalent all throughout World War I. In researching this episode, I was amazed to learn that many of the practices we have in place during this modern COVID era were actually utilized over 100 years ago during the 1918 pandemic. Things like mask wearing, social distancing, open-air events, and even quarantining. In fact, in the fall of 1918, San Francisco issued a mask mandate to slow the spread of infection. People who refused to wear masks faced fines, possible imprisonment, and ran the risk of having their names printed in the newspaper as mask slackers. For a bit of context, the term slacker was commonly used to shame people who didn't help with the war effort during World War I. It was a highly offensive term at the time, and also turns out to be a highly effective tactic. Now, we're not saying it's morally right to shame people into following the rules, but hell, it sure is funny. Imagine waking up in 1918 and pulling out your morning paper and reading a list of mask slackers. That would be like today if Twitter compiled all the handles of virus deniers and put a disclaimer that this account doesn't care about their community with every tweet. I've said this before on the podcast, but learning about the past is vital in helping us learn to navigate the future. In looking back into the 1918 pandemic, it honestly gave me a bit of hope. Pandemics like this have happened before and honestly are bound to happen again. Hopefully not in this lifetime, but who knows? In the end, understanding humanity's role in pandemics matters, because although we might like to think otherwise, humanity is fragile. Without even knowing it, we're constantly engaging with the natural world. We must learn to equip ourselves to better navigate this world we live in. In this upcoming holiday season, be mindful of your actions. I know I sound like a broken record, but please do wash your hands, wear a mask, and social distance. If you are traveling home for the holidays, it may even behoove you to wear a mask indoors and around family. I know it might feel awkward, but stick to your guns here. Set those boundaries and keep you and your family safe and healthy. The goal, after all, is to see your family again next year. Up next, my interview with infectious disease and modern pandemic historian Andrew Kishuni. All right, so for today's interview, we have Andrew Kishuni. He is a graduate student in history at the University of Central Florida and is a historian of modern pandemics and infectious disease. Andrew, thank you for being on Sit Still, Look Opinionated.
Thank you for having me.
Amazing. So before we get started with the interview, can you tell me just a little bit about your background and how you got into this field of study?
Sure. So as you said, I'm an accelerated bachelor's and master's student at University of Central Florida. And I've been studying the history of pandemics for about two or three years now. I began doing international security and history. So I became interested in pandemics just because I have family in the medical field, and I had always been interested in infectious disease and its role in shaping society and politics and the way we see the world. So I did my thesis, my undergraduate thesis, on the 1918 flu pandemic in the South with Dr. Connie Lester at the University of Central Florida. And that's how I got into what I do now. So.
Amazing. Did you ever think in your study of infectious disease that a global pandemic would occur?
No. I mean, when you begin studying infectious disease or public health or health security or epidemiology, there's always the expectation of an epidemic or a pandemic. There's always ones happening around the world, from Ebola to Zika to all these different kinds of viruses and bacteria and parasites that cause disease in humans. But a global pandemic of this magnitude, especially with the mortality that we see in the United States, I hadn't expected to see that in my lifetime. But the CDC and the National Institutes of Health and other public health agencies always warn about that. So it's something that should be expected, but you know, not to this level.
Yeah. I feel like that might be a little bit of a loaded question that I just asked you, especially in your field of study, that you probably get that a little bit, a lot nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately.
So in terms of COVID-19 and all these other viruses that you had just mentioned, like Zika and Ebola and things along those lines, why is COVID sort of having such a bigger moment? Like, why? I'd heard of Zika, I've heard of Ebola, but like those never, you know, came into my daily life. Why has COVID done this? Why is this the way it is, I guess?
Okay, that's a good question.
Yeah.
To approach it, I'll use a two prong answer. Mm-hmm. One is a microbiological one. COVID belongs to a family of coronaviruses, and they're just different than other viruses in the world. This virus has a long incubation period. It sleeps and is dormant for a while after infecting somebody to allow itself to reproduce very quickly and infect many people at one time before the person who is infected begins to feel symptoms and knows he or she is infected. So this COVID-19, the coronavirus, is different than something like Ebola, which has a high lethality rate, doesn't really give itself the time to spread because it kills its patient very quickly, especially because those patients are usually in West Africa or so, where there is a lacking public health infrastructure. So that's partially a microbiological answer. It's just a different kind of virus that has different capabilities than other viruses. It also doesn't really understand tropicalization. So Zika can only extend, its range can only extend where mosquitoes can go because it's vector borne. Same thing with dengue, same thing with malaria or yellow fever. It's tethered to the environment because it's tethered to mosquitoes. Mm. COVID doesn't really have that issue. COVID can, you know, move way beyond tropical zones. It's not vector borne, it's airborne. Or aerosolized. You know, public health agencies really haven't smoothed that out yet, but we do know that it transmits like the flu, which also doesn't really linger near the equator. So that's the first part to the answer, mm-hmm. or to the question, I'm sorry. The second component about why we are in the situation where we are is clearly, and this is coming from the historical side of things, a political issue. We see a distrust in public health that is rising. Even before COVID, we saw, you know, enormous anti-vaccination movements happening in America and elsewhere. We see a worldwide slant towards nationalism, which of course changes the way governments work. We see a distrust of immigrants or refugees or minorities, and an increase in things like white supremacy. And then we have populist leaders who back those movements because that's their base. And so the way they govern now reflects the interests of not so nice people, I guess you could say. And I think in America, that's part of the big reason why coronavirus has done what it has done. Is it comes down to political incompetence. And I think many public health figures and leading scientists acknowledge that we really dropped the ball on this one. We didn't trust the intelligence community fast enough. We didn't trust public health agencies fast enough. We didn't get the resources needed to fight a pandemic to where they needed to be. And so I hope that answers the question somewhat.
Yeah, for sure. I kind of want to dig into that a little bit more. You said you had a history in national security, you said. And yes. You sent me an article that had just been, that you just wrote and released about national security. Can you talk a little bit more about why national security doesn't come to the forefront when we think of ways to protect against the virus, or why it erupted? Can you talk about that from your experience?
That's another really good question. Diseases have always been central to security, even before the idea of a nation state, which came about only relatively recently in our human history. Diseases have changed wars. They've changed governments, from the Justinian plague all the way to coronavirus. We see how diseases are integral in shaping the way we govern, what we expect from our government, how war fighters fulfill their missions wherever they are. And so we know there's that history of pandemics deep in the bedrock of what we think of as security. But part of the reason why I don't think historians or policymakers or students or teachers have seen viruses or diseases as center to our concept of national security is that we're focused on anthropocentric threats, which just means that we're focused on threats that are very human, that it's a terrorist or a Nazi or a Japanese kamikaze or, you know, whatever it is that is very clear, very visible, and so we can kill it very quickly, or kill him or her very quickly with weapons that men use. And so we have this idea of history as being man versus man. And as I like to say, we never really thought of it as man versus microbe. And after the World Wars, you see military language being used to describe the fight against syphilis, the fight against the flu, as I study, and even all the way to the 80s, the fight against AIDS, and you have Cold War language and associating it with homosexuals, the gay plague. So we're always attaching people to something that cannot be seen without a microscope. So the China virus, the China plague, things like that. Which really do no good. But we can't really ever break from it because it's so core to our national security identity, not just in America, but around the world. We just don't really think of it that way. So
that really is interesting to me that we as humans, as a collective, have decided that we are greater than like this world that we live in. I think there's probably like a lot more to that. That's not really a question so much as just like realization. And sort of along those lines with like man versus man instead of like man versus microbe, as you'd said, why is it that like teachers and students, like I feel like I was never really taught about viruses in school. Like I felt like I learned about the bubonic plague and then like that ended and then everything was kind of okay. Like why is that not really in our collective knowledge, like that viruses and the study of those things don't really happen as much?
That's a good question. When you encounter microbiology, virology, bacteriology, things like that, it is almost always in a biology class or an organic chemistry class or something like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe in a public health class, if there is one in high school or so, an advanced for advanced students or something, or early college, but you'll never really see disease in a standard history course or a standard government course. And I think this is because bacteriology is relatively recent. And that's one thing I think students and interested observers must note is that We don't know the end of history. We're still in this historical lineage, and we're experiencing things in our moment that, you know, 50, 100, 1,000 years from now, people will look back, wonder why we didn't see what was in front of us the entire time.
Yeah.
Because that's what guys like Koch and Pasteur did in the late 1800s with the bacteriological revolution. It changed the way we thought about disease, introducing germ theory. Who knows what else lies in store for us as we continue to go further and further and further and further. So I think a lot of it has to do with just the conventional orthodoxy of education, just keeping microbiology as a science and not realizing how central it is to understanding our understanding of who we are and our understanding of our place in the world, which is partially the historian's job to unveil. So,
yeah, that I think about that a lot, and in terms of like how history, I've engaged with it in the past is, you know, I learn about World War II and then, you know, the end of the war comes and then you move on, and then it's like the end of this and then you move on. But that's not exactly how history works or how the world works. That's sort of just the narrative that we're told about. And again, that's not so much of a question as a unpacking of thoughts and things like that. So before, when you had mentioned about how all this language is written in about viruses and fighting them in terms of national security, are there other intersectionalities between like other major topics and viruses like climate change or other political moves? Like, are there more of those intersectionalities?
Definitely. And it's, I argue in, mm-hmm. in my work and in the article that you mentioned, I argue that they're still under the umbrella term of national security, but you can take them elsewhere too. And you mentioned an interesting one, climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change is big, big, big in studying the history of pandemics, or not just the history of them, but the actual pragmatic control of disease, which is the role of public health and public health practice. Deforestation is huge because it moves wild animals and pushes them into areas that they previously wouldn't have gone, that they hadn't gone for centuries. And, you know, those animals meet with domesticated animals, which is really where most of our diseases come from. You have cows and goats and pigs and chickens and all those kinds of animals, us living amongst them over millennia, okay, since the agricultural revolution, have produced disease. And so those wild animals meeting with domesticated animals, meeting with us, will undoubtedly cause a whole sprawl of different kinds of diseases. Influenza is just one example. Influenza, type A influenza viruses live among waterfowl, ducks and geese and birds like that. But when they move, when they migrate, when they alter their migratory patterns, and they link up with chickens and pigs, then we can see what some scientists call a spillover or a crossover event, where the genetic material of a virus that's spreading between those wild birds and those domesticated animals now spreads towards humans, because we live amongst pigs and chickens. We don't live amongst wild waterfowl. And so now we are predisposed to a disease that previously we hadn't encountered before. And thus you have a pandemic. So deforestation will cause things like that, climate change and rising sea levels, and, you know, and not just shaping the way diseases move around the world, but also the way humans move around the world. Food insecurity is a major threat that's associated with climate change, which will drive, you know, human populations around. And now you have people, you know, in megacities and in really poor conditions outside of those cities and shanties and things like that. And, you know, disease will run rampant in those communities. And so we never really can escape disease, or at least I don't think so. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, the French microbiologist, René Dubos, I think his name is, wrote a book called The Mirage of Health. And he talked about, you know, we'll never really perfect and make this medical utopia that we want to, that medicine has wanted to forever, because we're inextricably linked to the global ecology. But what we can do is elevate our societies above the pandemic threat and provide the corners of society that are capable of fighting viruses the tools they need to do the jobs that they trained so hard to do.
Mm-hmm. And that is super interesting. I guess maybe there's a better word there, but about, you know, escaping those moments that health can't do and like filling in those gaps and wondering like, will we ever be able to, you know, cure the common cold or cure cancer? Those are two wildly big ones. But does disease like serve a bigger purpose? Like, does it in this like ecological world we live in, like, is there a reason that diseases happen? I guess that's kind of maybe a little bit repetitive. Let me maybe clarify that. Like, do they help, you know, clear the sick so that more healthy environments can flourish? Does that make sense?
That's interesting. That's an interesting thought. I don't really know how to answer that.
Okay.
I think historians and epidemiologists in the past have tried to answer that,
mm-hmm.
especially in the 1920s, especially after the 1918 flu, which killed 50 to 100 million people worldwide, and infected 1/3 of the world. But they used it to try and back eugenic policies and scientific racist policies. They used it to embolden sterilization laws and anti-immigration laws and things like that. So in some ways, disease, I don't know that it serves a purpose, because we don't really gain anything out of getting sick. But what we do gain is immunity. So we know that to some degree, diseases will make parts of the population immune, and they'll have stronger immune systems. And this is something that many evolutionary psychologists have tried to explore, as something called parasite stress theory. It's the idea that society is shaped by its experience in disease, and something all the way back to the Hamilton-Zook hypothesis, where animals will show their ability to reproduce by showcasing it their immunity. And so like peacocks will show different feathers to try and showcase their strength, their genealogical strength, that they're fit to reproduce. But we also have some dangers there. Okay, while that is wildly fascinating, we have to remember that biological determinism has been used to propagate really nasty laws and really nasty practices because of racism, because of ideas of inequality and inequity, because of trying to preserve social order, because of trying to, you know, keep people away from voting or changing the status quo. So, you know, while those theories are exciting, we must be cautious in their use, because in the past they've been used to do some really bad damage.
That is kind of scary almost to think about, that the people in charge, people, whoever, society, culture, is pushing everyone in that society and culture to maybe believe a certain thing based off of race or socioeconomic status. And I wonder if that's starting to come to the forefront in a lot of people's minds in terms of voting, in terms of like the status of where we are in our country right now. And just for our listeners know, we're recording this on November 1st, so the election has not happened yet. So when this comes out, we will maybe, who knows what that will look like, but we'll fill that in a little later. So we are living in this age of COVID-19. Where does COVID-19 fit in the greater scheme of pandemics throughout time, if that makes sense?
Okay. I'm not familiar with having come across a coronavirus pandemic, mm-hmm. global pandemic caused by coronaviruses. The common cold is a form of coronavirus. But a pandemic of this magnitude, I'm not sure we've ever seen anything like it. But in the history of human pandemics, in the modern history is what I study, we were overdue for a pandemic, for a flu pandemic at least. Flu pandemics occur in a set range. I mean, every several decades, they tend to occur. So in the 20th century, we had the 1918 flu. We had the 1957 flu. We had the 1968 flu. And then earlier in our century, we've had the 2009 swine flu. So we see that there's kind of this like cyclical relationship between pandemics. We won't really escape pandemics, but I think it's important to see the evolution of society and the evolution of politics throughout history as we experience the pandemics, because the way we interact with the pandemic is just as important as the way the pandemic interacts with us. A lot of historians look at epidemics and pandemics as the way, as changing a society, but we also change the way a pandemic strikes us. And we do this with social architecture. We do this by preserving certain status quo. So in 1918, with what I study, African Americans are living in poverty in the South. But that's not as a result of their race. It is by design. And so when a pandemic strikes, like the 1918 pandemic, it disproportionately kills many African Americans in the South. And that's not surprising, because it's by design that African Americans are predisposed to a lethal pandemic that will kill them. And so in that way, I think coronavirus is in this lineage of social inequity and inequality in America and elsewhere, because we don't really seem to want to change that social architecture very much, unfortunately.
That's a great answer. Yeah. And the more and more I learn about pandemics and socioeconomics and just the way our culture all works, I realize every day that this is all interconnected. Every single thing, every topic we've gone over, I'm like, oh, this can link to that. Healthcare leads to security. Climate leads to understanding the pandemic better. So that's just, I'm learning every day that everything is interconnected in this world.
Right. I like to say, I see pandemics as a filter. And it's as if, or society is a filter and the pandemic is a light. And if you shine that light through the filter, you can see all the different holes. And those holes are all the intricacies of society that allow that pandemic to be as lethal as it is, or as non-lethal as it is. And so I think when we analyze society as historians and as scholars in a pandemic, it's as if the pandemic is accentuating all the things that we already knew were wrong, and just showing it and illuminating it clearer for us to see. So when you're studying a pandemic, historically, you're not studying just the microbiology or the biostatistics of the event. You're also studying what's happening in the society and all the issues that had previously been associated with that society. So that's a good way, I think, of looking at a pandemic.
Yeah, and that's totally true in today's world, you know, between the Black Lives Matter protests that have been happening throughout the summer and are keep happening in terms of voting, in terms of the climate, everything is just brought to the forefront because we're seeing it all happen now.
Yeah, we are biological beings, but we are also historical beings. Mm-hmm. We carry our biology with us because we're alive, we're organisms, but we also carry our history with us because we're part of this longer lineage of time that we carry with us politically, we carry it with us economically and socially, and we live it every day. Sometimes it's just unapparent, and pandemics make it apparent.
So in terms of America and in terms of like all of those things that we've been talking about, do you, in your historical opinion, think that anything will change? I say that lightly, but do you think that the projection we're on, the track we're on, anything will adjust, or will we just learn how to rework with this virus? In your
thing,
yeah.
I think a lot of it depends. I mean, acutely, it depends on how we vote in the coming 2 days, because that'll reflect a lot. I mean, it won't reflect on every individual in America, but it'll reflect to the world. It'll reflect on the American people. We have to remember, America is not just, the world doesn't end at our border. We're part of this international system. And so the rest of the world is looking at our country, and they're looking at, you know, What are Americans going to do about this virus? But yeah, I think on one side we have the continuity of distrust, mm-hmm. and the continuity of skepticism and expertise, which, if is not evident already, it is Trump's base, predominantly Trump's base. Mm-hmm. And then we have the trust in science and the trust in public health and the trust in what medicine is capable of doing, especially with the expansion of things like healthcare, especially with the expansion of civil rights, LGBTQ rights, black equality and equity, insights into gun violence, things like that that will give us a better understanding of ourselves as a society, and also at the same time providing context to the guys in medicine, the guys in public health, again, to do their jobs that they trained really hard, you know, spend their lifetimes trying to do, only to be shunned and distrusted, which is particularly egregious. But I think that after, I mean, and this is a historical example.
Yeah.
After 1918, you know, 50 to 100 million people dead, as I said earlier. But in America, 675,000 people died, which is a lot. That is more than every war in the 20th century combined. More Americans, I'm sorry, who died in every war in the 20th century combined. But not much changed. In fact, white supremacy increased. Ideas of preserving the social order, especially in the South, continued. It didn't really do much. And the U.S. creates the CDC in 1946 and enters the World Health Organization in 1948. And when the CDC is formed, it's not formed for fighting pandemics. It's formed for fighting malaria. I mean, that's why it's in Atlanta. The CDC is headquartered in Atlanta to provide the federal government the ability to fight malaria in the South, to protect farming communities and things like that. So for some reason, and I think it is because of our idea of national security, the minute you say something is a threat to national security, everybody listens. But because pandemics aren't really there in that conversation, they're not really taken as seriously, especially when, you know, we think that our medicine is so much more advanced than the microbial world outside. As coronavirus has shown, that is not the case. And I had previously been quite pessimistic about American progress in fighting viruses and in fighting pandemics. You know, the United States was in the game throughout the 20th century, and smallpox, you know, eradicated in 1980, and it was a huge victory. And then in 1981, HIV comes out of San Francisco and reminds everybody that we're not, you know, on a space shuttle flying away from diseases and never having to worry about it again. It's a hydra. It's a multi-headed hydra that we constantly have to figure out. The difference is we can arm ourselves with better swords. We can arm ourselves with better armor. We can do things that make it easier to fight pandemics in the future. And I think, and I'm very surprised to see it, because I had a historically pessimistic idea about progress, but I've begun to see a lot of voices, and it's a diverse range of voices, not only from different fields, but also different races, different ethnicities, religions and languages and cultures coming together to try and say, you know, we need to elevate ourselves above the pandemic threat. We need to mitigate risk for future generations. And we need to look at all the different ways that law intersects with climate change, intersects with technology, intersects with medicine, intersects with politics, all these things coming together to save the human race. And I hadn't expected to see that. So I guess my pessimism is changing. And hopefully we elect leaders that are willing to see change be exacted, not only at the social level, but also at the epidemiological level.
Mm-hmm. So since we've seen these like viruses that spring up, and you know, once one thing is cured, there's always the next thing. Is there any way that, you know, we as like a human race can prepare for that in any like geopolitical ideas or any other ways too?
So preparation is key.
Yeah.
And it's the cornerstone of public health. It's preparation and preempting and that's a military word or a military term, preempting, you know, a preemptive strike, you know. Well, we use those terms because it's a political term.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we preempt the threat, by proper surveillance, proper intelligence gathering in areas where trained people, epidemiologists and public health practitioners and microbiologists, are gathering data to show that a pandemic threat may emerge from this region or that region. I think surveillance is key. We need to know where viruses are. To do that, we need testing, not just human testing, but animal testing, which they do all the time. They test livestock and they test wild animals, and they try to find where these viruses are so we can track their journey throughout the world or throughout a region. And so I think emboldening that part of public health or of global health security is key. I think geopolitically, we can prepare for pandemics by being cooperative, by expanding what it means to be diplomatic, having healthy diplomatic relations, not frosty diplomatic relations as we have now on the American side. The U.S. is receding from the world. It's no longer a global player. It's not in the Paris Climate Accords. It's showing very little influence in the U.N. Under Trump's administration, removed its financing of the World Health Organization, mm-hmm. or threatened to, and then did. I think that's a very bad idea, especially in the middle of a pandemic that's around the world. We need governments to cooperate. We need intelligence agencies to cooperate. We need to know what they know, and they need to know what we know, so that we can have this, knowledge base that protects humans and not just Americans or Brits or French or Chinese or anybody else. We protect the human species. We need to begin looking. And coronavirus, it doesn't end with coronavirus. Mm-hmm. This is, and Dr. Anthony Fauci had mentioned this several weeks ago, that we're entering an age of pandemics. If he is correct, the coronavirus is the last thing that we need to worry about, because we have things like bird flu, which is every politician's worst nightmare. And I think the more we see that, the more that threat becomes realized, the more we see ourselves as global citizens responsible for one another across oceans, and not just this recession into borders and hiding and cutting off the lights and trying not to exist, only to exist to protect yourself or your family, a very nativist idea of politics. I think the more we expand our unit of analysis and realize we're a global community, not only do we transcend all the bitter problems that affected us before COVID, but we better prepare ourselves for pandemics that can definitely do something like it did in 1918.
And I feel like for some, global leaders, that might be a hard pill to swallow, is that you have to work with your enemy or, the person on the other side of the table of you. But right. Yeah, to save all of us, it might behoove us to work together.
Or at least find means to.
Yeah. Can you talk about what that means a little bit, like means to help each other?
Yeah. So, and there's, I think I'll approach this again on two levels. One, mm-hmm. at the political level, leaders, elected leaders, diplomatic leaders like ambassadors, military leaders. We need to find ways to strengthen our ties with our allies. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing, which we haven't done in the past 4 years. We've alienated them. We've isolated ourselves from them. And I think we need friends if we're going to fight global pandemics. We need friends like we did in Afghanistan, or in Iraq, or in Somalia, or in Libya. We need our allies with us on this, because there will be states that don't want to cooperate. So we need friends to back us up. And when you have that, you use coercive diplomacy, okay? You bend the arm, you use the carrot and the stick approach to get them to cooperate and try to make relations warm. Not all the time can you do that, mm-hmm. Not all the time. I mean, how are you going to have to cooperate with a dictator or a totalitarian regime? But we must find ways to do it. Even if it's not likable, even if the regime isn't likable, even if it has committed atrocities, we have to take that and put it in consideration, yes. But we also have to make sure that we're protecting ourselves in the process. And by forcing cooperation with other states, I believe, and I'm not a political scientist by any means, but I believe that that we can better prepare ourselves for pandemics at the political level. At the social level, as people, as community people, as voters in a democracy, I think we need to learn to love each other again. I think we need to find the unity part of community. I think we're not in a healthy position right now. Racially, it's very clear what's happening in the country. I think immigration-wise, it's very clear, you know, deploying the military to the border. That's not, I mean, I don't know how far that will take us in trying to prepare ourselves better for pandemics, which would harm immigrants as much as citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think fostering those healthy relationships with people in our community and finding the strength in diversity, finding the strength in having a range of cultures and a range of voices to voice the concerns of sections of the community that we don't always understand. I don't know what it is like to wake up Black. I don't know what it's like to be Black. So we listen to Black voices to tell us what it is to, what's the lived experience of waking up Black. And I think when we do that, we have a multidimensional frame of reference by which to go off of when we do write the playbook on how to mitigate a pandemic, or when we do tell the government what we expect them to do to protect us from pandemics. So I think that those two ways we can repair our ties with one another, and that makes us stronger.
Mm-hmm. That's always the same thing that we are asking our listeners to do, is to, if they don't understand something, reach out to someone and see what they can learn, and, you know, take that on themselves to learn and try to understand the world around you. And that's, you know, part of being opinionated, as we say, is being able to learn and know where you fall short.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think one of the big issues in the country now is being opinionated without having, or without being informed.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people who don't trust science, or don't trust, you know, their neighbors because their neighbors have a different skin color, or their neighbors speak a different language, I think a lot of that comes down to misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're the most informed, or I like to say this, we're the most informed age. We have the power of the world's libraries in our pockets. Formerly, you'd have to go to the Library of Alexandria, or the Library of Congress, or go to your local library and pull out a dictionary. Well, we have all of it in our pocket. We use it every day. Yet we are the most misinformed we have ever been. And I think if we inform ourselves and find the statistics, find the sources, and trustworthy sources, not just any, but trustworthy, reputable sources to go off of, I think we can learn to be healthy opinionated, opinionated in a productive way, in a constructive way.
Yes, and I echo all of those things. Andrew, this has been an amazing interview. If our listeners wanted to learn more about pandemics, or wanted to read up on your work or anything, where would you direct them?
So if you want to learn more about my work, you could just type me in on Google and see what I've done. I've written two articles for the Atlanta Sentinel, and they're short articles. So if you're interested in things like that, my thesis is on the UCF, I think it's called STAR. It's like a repository for theses and dissertations. And so it's called Pestilence and Poverty, the Great Influenza Pandemic and Underdevelopment in the New South, 1918 to 1919, if you're interested in that. And I also have a website, mappingfloridasflu.com, where I took a lot of the results from my thesis and I turned it into a data visualization project that users can interact with to understand mortality differential between white and Black Floridians in 1918, during that pandemic. And as per interest in disease, or the history of disease in general, that's a good question, because there's a lot out there. I think I'll answer that in a very general answer, not anything specific, like a specific disease, because then you enter a range of issues. But I think a good place to begin is William H. McNeil, and his book Plagues and Peoples. That's a very good one. I think another good one, I have two recent ones that I really enjoyed, is Mark Honigsbaum, his book The Pandemic Century, which is about the history of disease in the 20th century. It's very fascinating. And I recommend getting the updated version because there is a revised version for COVID.
Oh, great.
So he does provide some insight into coronavirus. Frank Snowden's Epidemics and Society is also very good. It's not exhaustive. It's not a comprehensive, you know, it's a big book, but it's not a, it's, you know, an enormous compendium of disease history, but it's a good analysis of the role of disease in shaping society and the way we think about society and the way we interact with each other within society. That's another good place to go. So I think those three are what I recommend. And if you're looking for something a little more on the science side, David Quammen wrote a book called Spillover, and that is also very good. It's his argument and analysis on how animal infections will cause the next human pandemic. And he wrote this a while back. So, you know, coronavirus is very time, or his book, I'm sorry, is very timely for coronavirus. So those four I'd recommend if you were to begin anywhere.
Great. Well, we will definitely link those in the show notes for sure. Andrew, thank you again for being on Sit Still, Look Opinionated.
Thank you for having me.
Today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week. Bye.